Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland, and in a recent episode, I explored how digital audio works and gave kind of a brief history on the MP3 file format. I warned you back then that that was part one of a three-part series, and today we're going to explore part two. So I hadn't forgotten about it. We're back to it. And today we're going to do a deeper dive with MP3s. And how do they compress audio? And how can you take a file filled with information and make it a smaller size? What do you have to give up in order to make files smaller? And today we're going to try and unravel the technical mystery behind the MP3. And I am not going to lie to you people. This is going to get a bit, you know, mathy. And I was an English major. So you mathematicians out there, get ready with your corrections, because I'm probably going to make some overgeneralizations for the purposes of my own sanity. There does get to a point where to really get into the technical details, it would likely be impossible for me to describe it in a way that would make sense and be accurate. And I have given my producer, Dylan, the mandate that should I get too cryptic and incomprehensible with my explanation, that he is to intervene in a way that he sees fit. Just not in the face, Dylan. Just not in the face. It's moneymaker, man. I gotta take care of it. So let's remember that the heart of digital information is the bit. That's either a zero or a one. The basic unit of information for digital formats. Zeros and ones. Now, we can use those zeros and ones to describe all sorts of information, from text to audio to video, and really pretty much anything you could think of that's represented digitally. Ultimately, when you get down to it, it's a bunch of zeros and ones. So let's say you start off with your uncompressed audio file. You've got this enormous audio file in front of you. It's made up of zeros and ones. How do you make that file smaller? So in the real world, we can compress stuff, right? We can apply physical pressure to things. Think about packing a suitcase. You can make sure you get that extra outfit in if you just press it down hard enough and get that zipper zipped before it can burst open. But once you get to a certain level of compression, you cannot make things smaller, at least not without hurting yourself or whatever it is you're trying to compress. Digital files are a little different because you cannot physically cram the zeros and ones closer together. It doesn't work like that. These are abstract things. You can't make them smaller, right? You can't decrease the font. It doesn't work that way. The numbers represent two different states. So if you want to create a smaller audio file containing the recording that was in a larger audio file, you have to start getting creative. Now, in the last part of this series, I talked about how the MP3 compression algorithm was born from an applied research institution in Germany, and the team behind the MP3 wanted to find a way to compress audio, specifically music, for transmission over phone lines. Eventually, this evolved into the Motion Pictures Expert Group Audio Layer 3 compression methodology, better known as the MP3. And there's also MPEG 2 and MPEG 4 standards. MPEG 2, by the way, is the basis of compression on DVDs, although the actual DVD format is really a modification of MPEG 2. And MPEG 4 is a compression strategy for audio and video that's frequently used in lots of different capacities, including streaming media services. So by the late 1970s, researchers began to explore the possibility of leveraging psychoacoustics to figure out how to compress audio. And psychoacoustics refers to the way we perceive sound. And also the physiological effects of sound on us. So this involves not just our physical sense of hearing, but also our brains and the way our brains interpret sound. So, for example, there's a psychoacoustic phenomenon that's called the Haas effect, H-A-A-S, and I think it's pretty interesting. So here's how the Haas effect works. If you hear the exact same sound coming from different directions, but the two sounds arrive within 30 to 40 milliseconds of each other, your brain will be convinced that you really only heard one sound, and it came from the direction that hit you first. So let's say a sound's coming from directly in front of you and to your left, and you get both of them within that 30 to 40 millisecond range, and you hear the one coming from ahead of you first. To you, you're convinced that you only heard that sound once, and it came from dead on straight ahead of you. Your brain kind of discounts the one that came off from the left, although it can reinforce it, which ends up being really useful if you're planning out PA systems for stage shows. I'm not joking. That really is the way that people plan those things out. It's pretty neat. We humans perceive sounds in a way that's not necessarily representational of all the sounds surrounding us. You can think of your brain as the filter between your understanding and what reality actually is. A lot of stuff goes on that ends up getting rid of information that your brain just says, you know what, he or she doesn't need that. It's just going to confuse things. We're going to dump it. And that's kind of how it works. It's all on an unconscious level. It's not like you're actively working to do this. So let's say you're in a relatively busy hallway, and there could be a lot of sounds in that hallway, stuff that's going on constantly around you. Maybe there are doors opening and closing. Maybe there are footsteps going up and down the hallway. Maybe someone's shoes are squeaking against the linoleum floor. People are chattering away in there, but you are having a conversation with someone. So you turn your focus on that person, and other sounds seemingly fade away. They're still present, but they're not important. So in this example, you would actually call those other sounds a distraction, and you would really focus on the conversation. That also shows how we're able to consciously direct our sense, our perception of hearing. So both of these factors come into play. Now, one thing that MP3 encoding takes advantage of is something called masking. And there are a couple of different variations of the masking effect. One of them is called frequency masking. So let's say you've got two sound frequencies that are similar. Perhaps they're just a few hertz apart. Remember, frequencies are measured in hertz, which is really the number of oscillations per second. So let's say you've got a sound that's at, 1,000 kilohertz, and another one that's at 1,010 kilohertz. Now, the human ear is precise enough to be able to tell the difference of two sounds that are at least 2 hertz apart from each other. That's how precise our resolution of hearing, it's at that level. But if you get 2 sounds played at the same time, and they are that close together in frequency, and one of those frequencies is played at a greater volume than the other, our brains will pick up on the louder sound and ignore the quieter sound, even though both of them are present. What becomes important at that point is the amplitude. Now, the further apart in frequencies you get, the less that has an effect. So if you get far enough apart where there are 2 pitches, one of them noticeably louder than the other, but they're far enough apart, you will hear both of them. It only works if the 2 pitches are relatively close together. And there's not a universal formula for frequency masking. As you get closer to the boundaries of human hearing, frequency masking becomes easier. So if it's a really low pitch or a really high pitch, it's easier to get away with it. Once you start getting into what is thought of as the sweet spot for human hearing, which is generally considered to be between 2 and 5 kilohertz, you need a greater difference in volume or a smaller difference in frequency in order for masking to work. Frequency masking, at any rate. But then there's also temporal masking. And you might say, okay, I got it. Temporal, that means time. Indeed it does, my friend. This describes the effect of a short but loud sound masking a softer sound for a short time. Weird thing is, the loud sound can actually mask sounds that precede it slightly. Not by a whole lot, but a little bit. MP3 compression takes advantage of both frequency and temporal masking when it's trying to determine which data needs to be included and which data can be dumped because it won't affect your perception of whatever the audio file is in the first place. So you also probably remember I talked about the physical limitation to what we humans can hear, no matter what our brains might be up to. So this doesn't have to do with our brains, you know, filtering through the information that's coming in. This has to do with the physical limitations of the human ear. In the last episode of the series, I said typical human hearing, keep in mind typical, there are exceptions, covers the range of frequencies between about 20 hertz and 20 kilohertz, or 20,000 hertz. So 20 to 20,000. Higher frequencies represent higher pitches in sound, lower frequencies, lower pitches, right? And as you get older, your ability to perceive those higher frequencies starts to diminish. So most adults actually have an upper range closer to 16 kilohertz, not 20. Kids, they can hear those higher pitches. You may have heard the story about how some convenience stores experimented with getting rid of teenage loiterers by projecting out these super high pitches that adults could not hear, but kids could, and it discouraged kids from hanging out at the convenience store and loitering. I love that idea so much. Anyway, that's because I'm old and my hearing is terrible. Well, remember, I also mentioned you can detect changes in pitch at 2 hertz increments. If you get below 2 hertz in change, like if it's just a 1 hertz difference between 2 frequencies, it's too low a resolution for us to detect. To us, it'll sound exactly the same. So if you were to hear a frequency at 1,001 hertz, or 1.001 kilohertz, and 1.002 kilohertz, you wouldn't notice the difference. They would sound exactly the same to you. So if you're going to take audio and compress it, one step you could consider is eliminating anything that is outside the actual range of frequencies that we can hear, or simplifying any changes in frequency that are smaller than 2 hertz. If you take all that data and you say, it is physically impossible for a human to perceive this, get rid of that information, then in theory, it wouldn't have any effect on the rest of the recording. But how do you go further than that, right? How do you create a method so that you can really compress this file? You want a method that will preserve the important sounds while potentially ignoring all the unimportant or incidental sounds. And you want it to be automatic, because if you have it manually, then that's going to take countless hours just to edit a single sound file. So that was the challenge that the MP3 research team faced as a group. Now, their solution which ultimately created even more challenges, was to come up with what was essentially a simulated human ear and brain. They needed to replicate the experience of perceiving music so that an algorithm could evaluate every sound in an audio file and judge if it in fact was relevant enough to include in the final compressed version. If a sound were imperceptible, then it wouldn't make sense to include it in the MP3 file. So by leaving out all the irrelevant data, they could make the audio information take up less bandwidth. The file itself would be smaller because you just dumped everything that wasn't important. So the team used an algorithm called the Low Complexity Adaptive Transform Coding, or LC-ATC, as the foundation for their research. This was kind of their starting point. And this is an approach that tries to do away with redundancy as much as possible, and it also incorporates adaptation to perceptual requirements. Also, MP3s owe a lot to the MPEG Layer 2 standard. So the Layer 2 obviously came out before Layer 3, and so a lot of the features of Layer 3 are really their legacy features from Layer 2. In other words, MP3 group kind of got stuck with them because otherwise they would have had a problem with backwards compatibility. So the result is kind of a clunky arrangement under the hood, and some of the features may make very little sense when I go through them, but some of that's because it's a holdover from an earlier compression strategy, which isn't terribly satisfying as an answer, but the reason many parts of the MP3 compression algorithm are the way they are is because that's the way we've always done it. So next I'm going to dive into the phases of compression. But before I do that, let's all take a deep breath and take a moment to thank our sponsor. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Back. So there are two big phases we'll need to talk about with MP3 compression. The first phase is analysis, and the second phase is the actual compression itself. And after that, there's the process of decoding an MP3 for playback, but that's way simpler once we get an understanding of how the encoding process actually happens. So let's begin with analysis. Now, this is the part where the standard has to figure out which frequencies within an audio range, or recording rather, are important or perceptible. So how does a program, an encoder, figure out what we can hear and what we cannot hear? All right, time to get technical. So you start off with your pulse code modulation audio file, or PCM file. And you might remember I talked about PCM audio in the first episode of this series. But just in case you don't, it's a lossless digital audio file. The actual format could be a WAV or AIFF or something along those lines. But the important thing to keep in mind is that it is uncompressed. Now, that means those files tend to be pretty big. This is our raw material that we want to take and squish down to a more manageable, transferable size. And in our last episode in this series, I also mentioned that the standard for CD audio is a sample rate of 44.1 kilohertz. And we learned that you need a sample rate twice the frequency of the highest frequency in your recording. And since human hearing tops out at around 20 kilohertz, the standard for CDs is 44.1 kilohertz. The MP3 standard can support lots of different sample rates, but 44.1 kilohertz is pretty much the common standard. So you've got a number of samples with your audio file, and that number will depend upon how long the audio file is. You've got 44,100 samples per second. Actually, twice that for stereo. But for the purposes of this discussion, let's kind of stick with mono sound so that I don't start having math coming out of my ears. And we're still in the very easy, simple part as far as math goes. We haven't gotten to the complicated stuff yet. All right, so you got 44,100 samples per second. To compress it into an MP3 format, the algorithm first groups all of these samples into collections called frames. So take those 44,100 per second, and then you start saying, okay, we're going to group you in batches. Each batch is called a frame, and each frame contains 1,152 samples. Now, that's specifically to maintain backwards compatibility to MPEG Layer 2, which established that 1,152 number. But we're not talking about MPEG Layer 2, we're talking about MPEG Layer 3. And though that means we have to get a little more complicated. So each frame consists of two subgroups called granules. So each granule has 576 samples. 576 times 2, 1,152. So 576 samples per granule. Now, technically, MP3 encoders only work on one granule at a time, but they may reference the granules immediately before and immediately after the current one in order to see how the audio within the file changes over time. All right, so now you've got your granules of 576 samples each. Then the MP3 encoder runs the samples through a filter bank, which sorts the sound into 32 frequency ranges. Are you crazy about the numbers yet, Dylan? Are you? Dylan's nodding. Dylan, it gets worse from here. So you have 32 frequency ranges, which is another nod to the Layer 2 method, which uses those 32 ranges for encoding purposes. But we're not talking about Layer 2, are we? No, we're talking MP3, gosh darn it. That means we take those 32 ranges and we subdivide them by a factor of 18. That means we have 576 bands of frequencies, each band containing 1/576th of the frequency range of the original sample. So what that actually means, and this is actually pretty easy, the bands are not limited to a specific number for their frequency range, right? The bands don't mean that on band number one, it goes from 20 hertz up to a certain range, and on band 576, it ends at 20 kilohertz. That's not what it means. They're dependent upon the original audio. So if the original audio contains sounds within a narrow range of frequencies, the 576 bands will be more precise. But if the original recording has a vast range of frequencies, the bands are less precise. So another way to think about this is with a pizza. So let's say you get an extra large pizza and you cut it into 8 equal slices. And then you get a small pizza and you cut that into 8 equal slices. Well, in both cases, you have, with each slice, 1/8 of a pizza. But the extra large pizza slice is bigger than the small pizza slice. It all depends on the size of the pizza. So in this case, it depends upon the range of frequencies. And Dylan, do you think we could go for some pizza? You know, just put the episode on hold and go get pizza? Dylan's nodding. It's great for audio. Pizza. We'll be right back. Okay, that was good pizza. Now, I got a whole bunch more notes. Okay, well, let's go ahead and do the rest of this. All right, so you've got your sound divided up into those 576 sub-brands of frequencies. You know, the thing I compared to pizza slices earlier. Now you get two different mathematical processes applied to this data. One is the fast Fourier transform, or FFT, and the other is the modified discrete cosine transform, or MDCT. Now, I am not going to dive deeply into how these transforms work because, frankly, they are beyond my mathematical understanding. But I know what they do. I just cannot explain the process, like how they do what they do. So I'm going to give you the explanation of what they do, what the outcome of each of these transform processes happens to be. But I'm not going to be able to tell you the actual mathematical steps involved in each because I don't math so good, guys. But let's start with the fast Fourier transform. So a transform is kind of what it sounds like. It's all about transforming information in some way. So in this particular case, the FFT transforms the frequency bands we just talked about into data that can be further analyzed by a psychoacoustic model that's in the encoder. So this is that simulated human ear and brain we were talking about earlier. So what the encoder does is it analyzes each bit of data and looks for signs that it represents audio that wouldn't be perceived by a human. So it's looking for any potential for masking possibilities. So are there collections of frequencies that are grouped close together, and is one of those frequencies louder than the others? You might be able to do away with those softer frequencies because of frequency masking. The encoder will also look at whether or not the audio has a lot of complexity to it. If it has a lot of changes, or if it's just relatively steady or simple audio, any transient sounds that are present in the audio might end up being temporal masking. So it'll analyze those as well and see if that's a possibility. So really what they're looking is for, you know, just any really loud sounds that stand out above the rest of the recording. That's what the FFT is doing. So what about the modified discrete cosine transform? Well, this is happening in parallel with the FFT, and the samples get sorted into different patterns called windows, and the criterion for sorting all has to do with whether the sample represents a steady sound or varied sound. So if you have a simple, steady sound, that goes into a long window. If there's a lot of variation in the sound, like there are a lot of consonants in a vocal line, or it's like a drum solo or something like that, it would get sorted into a series of three short windows, and each short window contains 192 samples. That amounts to 4 whole milliseconds, so 4/1000ths of a second in 3 pattern windows. So you've got these windows now, either long windows for simple sounds or short windows for the more complex sounds. And then the modified discrete cosine transform kicks into gear. It looks at each long window or set of three short windows and converts them into a set of spectral values. To some of you, that probably sounds meaningless. So let's talk about spectral analysis for a second. First, I was very disappointed to learn that spectral analysis doesn't involve a psychologist talking to a ghost about its emotional state. So, bummer. But spectral analysis is when you look at a spectrum of information, like a spectrum of frequencies, or related information, like energy states. That's what this transform does. It takes data that originally represented a slice of time in a sound waveform. That's what a sample is. A sample is an instance of time in a waveform, and converts it into information representing sound as energy across a range of frequencies. Now, you can plot out spectral information in a lot of different ways, but one common method is to use brightness to indicate energy levels. higher energy levels are brighter patches in your visual representation of spectral data. High frequencies would appear at the top of a spectral view. Like, imagine a box. And at the top of the box, that's where you would find high frequencies. At the bottom of the box, that's where you find low frequencies. And it's just lots of patches of color. The really bright patches of color represent very high energy frequencies. So they could be high or low in actual frequency, but we're talking about energy levels, not whether it's a high or low pitch. Looking left to right represents the passing of time, and looking along any vertical point shows you the actual frequency or pitch, and then the respective energy level is the brightness. So it's kind of like looking at sound as a wave, but instead of it being a wave, you're looking at information that indicates frequency range and energy level. That representation is actually kind of analogous to how we hear audio. So an encoder can analyze the spectral view and start to filter out the data we wouldn't perceive due to psychoacoustics. Now, after all that processing, the encoder looks at the 576 frequency subbrands and the levels of spectral intensity for each. And that information can then be used for the next phase, which is compression. But right now, I think we could all stand a little decompression. So let's take another quick break to thank our sponsor. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI. And Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, so now you're ready to compress your analyzed audio. Good for you. And by you, I mean encoders. This has to be simpler than that analysis segment, right? I mean, that got a little crazy with all the different bands and subbands and windows and frames and granules. Sadly, it gets more complicated. All right, so there are two layers of compression going on with MPEG Layer 3. One of those layers, depends upon the psychoacoustic analysis and the other doesn't. So why would you use two layers with different strategies like that? Well, the reason is that one strategy is great for complex audio with lots of components, but not so great with simpler sounds, and the other strategy is kind of the opposite. So the psychoacoustic approach is the one that's really good for complicated sounds. If you've got a lot of volume changes, lots of different frequencies, it's just complicated and rich sound, you've got a lot of opportunities to look for masking and other acoustic elements that limit the actual sounds that people perceive. So it means there are a lot of chances for you to fudge by dropping all the stuff that people probably wouldn't notice anyway. And if you take a piece that's got a lot of elements at varying volumes, there are likely several opportunities to do this. But if you're talking about relatively straightforward audio with few components, few changes in volume, there's really not a whole lot of data you can ditch without it actually affecting the quality of the audio in a perceptible way. And this is part of what Brandenburg, that guy I was talking about in our first episode in this series, that's what he discovered when he was working with the MP3 standard and he was listening back to that Suzanne Vega a cappella track, Tom's Diner. He was listening to a compressed version of it and he said it was terrible. He said it ruined the quality of the audio. And part of that is because that particular song is fairly simple. There's just not a lot of opportunity to take advantage of masking and other tricks without potentially compromising the quality. So they decided to also incorporate some traditional compression strategies, which work better with those types of recordings. So the MP3 format takes advantage of both the traditional approach and the psychoacoustic approach. And that allows the encoder to compress files into smaller size without just following a single strategy. Like, it doesn't have to do a one-size-fits-all for all elements of audio. Now, combining those two strategies requires a little more mathematical gymnastics. So let's go back to those 576 frequency bins. You know, those sub-bands we talked about earlier. You gotta quantize those suckers. What does that mean? It means assigning a quantity to each frequency bin. You have to give it a quantity of some sort so that you can end up judging how much you can get away with dropping data. So to do this, the encoder sorts those 576 bins into 22 scale factor bands. How you doing over there, Dylan? Just checking in on you. Okay. Dylan's got a 1,000-yard stare going. Hope you guys are doing okay over there. All right, so before smoke starts coming out of your ears, let me explain what the scale factor bands are all about. The whole purpose of the scale factor bands is to determine how the information will be stored within the compressed state. So you want to get away with as little data as possible before affecting sound quality. So if you can say the same thing in a shorter space without affecting the quality of what it is you're saying, you go with it. Brevity is the soul of compression. So if we were talking about language, I would say it's more efficient to say it's raining outside, or even just it's raining, because you would assume that it would be outside where the rain is happening. And it would be inefficient for me to say it's coming down like cats and dogs out there. It's not as efficient as saying it's raining. So if you can get away with shorter statements without affecting the actual quality, and you could argue that by switching from it's coming down like cats and dogs out there and it's raining changes the quality, and that could be a valid argument. But if you can get away with shorter without affecting quality, you do it. So each scale factor band is represented by a quantity. Then the encoder divides that quantity by a given number called the quantizer, which is the same across the entire frequency spectrum for that recording. The resulting number is then rounded up or down to a whole digit. And here's an important point. Individual scale factor bands can be scaled up or down for more or less precision to represent the actual value of those bands. So what the heck does all that mean? Well, the purpose of dividing and rounding is just to simplify the data, to reduce the amount you need in order to store the information. So let's go with a totally hypothetical example. Let's say you've got a scale factor band, and you've decided you're representing that scale factor band with the quantity 7840. And you've chosen the number 100 to quantize your data, meaning that you will divide each scale factor band's quantity by 100. So this is 7840. You divide it by 100. And the scale factor for this particular band you have determined is 1.0. That means that once you get that result where you've divided the quantity by the quantizer, you multiply by 1. That means there's no change. You multiply by 1, you get the same number. More on that in a bit. Okay, so you take that 7,840, you divide it by 100, that gives you 78.4. Well, now you have to round that number. So you round it down to 78. Now, when you have a decoder and you're ready to play back the information, it comes across this quantity, this 78, and it knows what the quantizer number was, so it multiplies by 100 to get back to 7,800. So the replicated number is actually 40 off from the original number. That original number, again, was 7,840. The replicated number is 7,800. Now, those inconsistencies manifest as noise in the actual playback. So if you wanted to increase the precision of any given scale factor band, you could do so by changing the scale factor number. So in that example just now, I said the number was 1.0, meaning there's no change to that result. But I could have said it was 10, which means we would multiply the quantized number by 10. So we would take that 7,840, divide by 100, you get 78.4. You would then multiply by 10 to get 784. So when the decoder decompresses the file, it would reverse this whole thing. It would just multiply by 100. You would end up getting 7,840 again, which means that you wouldn't introduce any noise to the file. You would have a perfect representation. But in some cases, the encoder may determine that any noise that you generate wouldn't be noticed, or it wouldn't impact the quality of the audio enough for it to be a problem because of other factors for that particular scale factor band. Like maybe it's really quiet, or maybe it's really complex. So in those cases, you could reduce the scale factor number by making it something else, like 0.1 instead of 1.0. So that means you would multiply the quantized number by 0.1. So the 78.4 would become 7.84, and then you have to round it to get a whole integer, so you get 8. 7.84 rounds up to 8. Now when a decoder decompresses the audio, it multiplies 8 by 100, that quantizer that we've talked about so much. Actually, at this point, it would have to be 8,000 because it's also taking into account the scale factor. So it's multiplying it by 1,000, not just 100. So you would get a number that would pop up to 8,000. And remember, the original was 7,840. So you look at the difference between these two. The original 7,840. The new number is 8,000. There's a pretty big difference there. That change might introduce enough noise for it to be a problem. So how does the encoder determine if a scale factor band is meeting the proper criteria? How can it tell if there is too much noise or if the noise falls below the threshold? Well, it goes through what is called a Huffman coding process. At this point, Dylan is currently just staring at the wall and drool is coming out. Huffman coding process, it converts scale factor bands into binary strings. And the process goes through a series of tables to determine if the data within the scale factor band requires more or less precision to describe the sound without affecting the audio quality. So Huffman coding is a process in which you start with a large number of possibilities and you begin to narrow it down. Some people describe it as the coding equivalent of 20 questions. So you ask your first question, like animal, vegetable, or mineral, you get an answer. So animal. Well, that first answer eliminates a ton of other possibilities and narrows the focus. Like anything that doesn't pertain to animal, you can automatically discount because you already know it can't apply to that answer. With MP3 compression, this means making certain the number of bits representing a granule, because remember, I mentioned that in MP3 formats, you have frames, and each frame has 1,152 samples and consists of two granules with 576 each. So when you answer the first question, it eliminates a lot of other possibilities and narrows the focus. So like with animal, vegetable, or mineral, if I say animal, you're going to not ask any questions that have to do with minerals or vegetables only because it wouldn't make sense. you know those aren't going to apply. Same thing with MP3s, except this time it means making certain the number of bits representing a granule, remember they're 2 granules per frame with the MP3 layer, you want to make sure that the number of bits representing that granule match the chosen bit rate for compression. So if after going through this process, the encoder says, hey, this granule has more bits than what's allowed, it's too many bits, we got to get rid of some of these, the encoder can adjust the scale factor band so that there's less precision, meaning that multiplier, in other words, that bit I talked about earlier, and thus reduce the amount of data needed to represent that particular granule. If a granule comes in under the bit rate, the encoder can increase the precision to reduce noise and fill that granule out properly so it matches the actual threshold. After all this, the pairs of granules become frames within the MP3 files, and the only other component in an MP3 file, apart from these frames, is the ID3 metadata. This is pretty simple. This is like a header, and it comes before all the frames in the audio file and contains information about the file itself, which can include stuff like the title of a song, an artist name, an album title, other stuff like that. It can also include copyright information, as well as information about the file itself, such as whether or not it's a stereo recording or a mono recording. So when you use a decoder, like an MP3 player, it takes this compressed information, these representations that the music has been reduced to, and it converts that Huffman data back into the quantized format, scales the data back up to its original size or close approximation. Remember, the uncompressed version may actually be off by a significant amount depending upon each individual granule. And all of that data gets recombined into a new PCM sample that can be played back to you. And that's all there is to it. Nothing could be easier. All right. That took a lot out of me. So it got really technical, and I apologize if I lost any of you out there. Or for those of you who have a lot of experience working on compression algorithms, for oversimplifying in several cases. But now we've got a full episode about this. And now I hope you have a better understanding of how a big sound file can be reduced to a smaller sound file. Next time I'll just say magic. It'll make everyone happier. But I hope you guys appreciated this. In the next episode in this series, it'll be far less technical. I'm going to be more historical. I'm going to talk about the progression of the MP3 player, how it came about, how it evolved, and how the iPod ended up becoming the dominant brand in a sea of MP3 players. And then maybe kind of explore where MP3 players are today. Like, how many are there? How big is the market? Are people still buying them? That kind of question. If you guys have any questions for me, or comments, or suggestions, anything like that, send me a message. My email is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Or you can drop me a line on Facebook or Twitter. The handle at both of those is techstuffhsw. And I'll talk to you guys again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit nfl.com/schedule-release to learn more.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.